to happen.
This is part two of my two-part interview with the host of the Mythbusters. Hope you enjoyed part one. If you didn't get a chance to hear it, where are your priorities? Seriously, people, come on. In this part of the interview, the guys get into their background a little bit more. They talk about the work that they do day to day on the show, how to blow stuff up, how to kill people with two fingers. Okay, that part they didn't say. But it's a really cool conversation. Check it out. I hope you enjoy it. And if you want to check me out doing stand-up, I'm going to be at the Sacramento Punchline this Thursday, April 18th through Sunday, the 21st. Thursday through Sunday, April 18th to the 21st at the Sacramento Punchline. Hope to see you out on the road and enjoy the podcast.
We got the streets, suckers! Can you dig it?
But so then where did you started down the path of acting. You played a drowning boy in a Billy Joel video.
I did. I worked on Billy Joel's worst music video, and I recognized the bar is pretty low. I worked on a version of It's a Wonderful Life that they filmed for the video You're Only Human.
Right.
And Billy honestly could not have been a nicer, more gentlemanly guy to work with. I spent 3 days shooting around the New York area with him. I got to meet Christy Brinkley back then at the peak of their marriage and fame. It was an awesome experience. I really loved looking at that video.
And then what took you down that path of like of acting? Just felt like that's where you belonged at the time.
It was always something that came pretty easily to me, performing and being the center of attention. That was actually both the thing that I wanted to do, but it was also the problem. It came easily to me, and so I thought that success would come easy to me. And after about 4 years of trying to do commercials and stuff and nothing really happening, I gave up on it because I didn't really realize how hard you had to work at something, even something you were good at.
Yeah.
I ended up getting a job in graphic design, assistant animation, theater, and then theater led to theater prop making, set building, rigging, and that eventually led to moving to San Francisco to do the same thing and getting hired by Jamie in film special effects, that other people in the theater industry started noting my work and mentioning it to professionals in the film industry, and Jamie gave me a call. Before I knew it, I'd looked up and I'd spent 12 or 15 years making stuff for a living before Mythbusters showed up.
Well, Jamie, was there anything in particular of his work that you saw or heard about that sort of said, wow, I got to put this guy on my radar? Like, what was he doing? I mean, that's quite a level of experience and resume that Adam just recounted. But, like, do you remember if there was anything in particular that stood out for you?
He just seemed to be very versatile. And, you know, It actually wasn't anything that I saw when he showed up that was what made it. It was actually once I hired him, working with him, I could see that he was, above all, he was really fast, which in our business is super important. And you know, fast and actually quite accurate at the same time, and versatile. And so, you know, there's not that many people that fit into that category where, you know, we'll go into the machine shop and make something and go over and weld something and then go over and, you know, sculpt something or what have you.
I'll tell you something about that job when Jamie first called me. I had tried to work in special effects in commercials and in film three other times before Jamie called me. And each of those times I had sought somebody out, gone to an interview and tried to work with them and then spent time working with them, getting paid really crappily and working in places that I didn't like. And it never took. Like, either the shop itself was crappy or the people were really unhappy or the pay was really awful. And so when Jamie called me, I didn't have a plan. He just said, "Do you want to come in and show me your stuff?" And I thought, oh, actually, I got to say this. I was working for Berklee Repertory Theater at that point, and they were doing a stage adaptation of Maxine Hong Kingston's book, The Woman Warrior. And I was building a robot for them, a remote control lazy boy chair for their national touring show.
Wow.
And so I was thinking, this is great. A special effects guy just called me up, and I got to tell them, I can't come in this week. I'm building a remote control lazy boy chair.
There you go. That's...
But I can come in a couple of weeks. And when I did, instead of coming in with a resume, I came in with a box full of stuff that I'd built. I thought, I'm going to just put my best foot forward. And that's the best calling card I had.
Right.
And I remember very specifically, Jamie and I sat there in this old shop on Quint Street and went through these things that I'd built. And, you know, he's told, oh, okay, yeah, that's sort of like this kind of stuff that we do. And then I had just watched a special effects guy named Chris Wayless, who owned the shop that did all the spiders for Arachnophobia and all the stuff for Naked Lunch. I'd seen him on Carson.
Mm-hmm.
And Chris Wayless had been demoing one of the spiders from Arachnophobia.
On Carson.
On Carson, yeah.
Cool.
Because it was the biggest movie in the country at that point.
Sure, I remember that.
The spiders were these masterpieces of engineering, which had this kind of organ grinder box that made the spiders walk. And I intuited exactly how that box worked just from watching him operate it on Carson. And I was telling Jamie this story. He let me tell this elaborate story about how I could tell how the box worked and its mechanics and everything. And then when I was finished, Jamie explained that he had actually designed and built that organ grinder box.
That's awesome.
And I thought, home run. No better way you could start off a job interview than by complimenting the guy who you're talking to.
Oh, that's exactly right. Well, you know, it's funny because, like, for me, at least from where I sit and learning more about Jamie's background was, you know, the survival camp and going out on his own for a couple of years or summers. For you, Adam, and I, this resonates with me, you would make your own costumes for Halloween, but, like, not like, oh, a pirate costume. You made a robot costume out of roof flashing with 700 rivets. Is that correct?
Actually, I've always been obsessed with suits of armor. And somewhere, I guess it's like 82,
mm-hmm.
John Borman's Excalibur came out.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the great, great rip-snorting bodice and sword movies ever made.
Right.
And my dad took me to it twice, which I couldn't believe. I convinced him to take it to me twice with the really graphic sex scenes that were in it. but I was totally obsessed with suits of armor, and the suits of armor in Excalibur are designed and built by Terry English, who's done armor for everything up to and including like the Colonial Marine armor from Aliens. He's now actually the armorer for the Queen of England. And my dad and I started building a suit of armor for me out of roofing aluminum. And I wore it to high school on Halloween, I think my sophomore year, and promptly passed out in math class of heat exhaustion in this suit of armor. And I literally remember I was carried to the nurse's office, and I woke up in the nurse's office, and my first words were, "Where's my armor?"
Well, and the other part of this is because you had said, if I understand this correctly, like, everybody else would dress up as hobos for Halloween, which was the thing that rung the bell for me, because my parents were so lazy, my mother in particular, about costumes. It was always last minute. So she'd find, like, some old hat and some old jacket, and she'd get shoe polish and throw it on my face and send me out. And I was a hobo for 6 years running. And it was like, you know, why even bother? I'm just going to go out as me. Like, struck a chord with me.
I remember it's 1978. I'm 11 years old, and Jaws was the biggest movie. And there was a Jaws Halloween costume that I wanted. And my parents were pretty poor when I was growing up. They were kind of scraping by. But my mom indulged me in this extravagance of buying me the Jaws costume, which was so shitty. It was literally like a mask of a shark made in, you know, vacuum form plastic with a vinyl tunic that said Jaws on it. That was my shark costume, and I loved it. I was like totally into it.
Oh, that's awesome. The switch over for both of you guys, like for Jamie, you had all that fascinating early life experience. What was the first job or set of jobs that sort of took you on the path of special effects? Like, how did you make that leap from, I know you have a Russian linguistics degree from Indiana University, but how do you go from Russian linguistics studies to special effects?
Well, it didn't happen by accident or some random introduction. I decided that I wanted to get into special effects.
Mm-hmm.
I researched all my options at the time, and then I decided that's what I wanted to do, and so I methodically went about getting my foot in the door.
But see, that's fascinating to me. How old are you at the time, and who thinks I don't know about you, Adam, but who thinks, I don't know, at that age, what are you, 17, 18, 19, 20? Who thinks special effects? Like, where does that even come into a person's brain? Like, how did that come about?
Well, actually, that was a ways, you know, when I decided to get into it, that was, you know, let's see, that would have been, 30 years ago. So I was 26 or something like that.
Oh, okay. Got it.
And so, the way that it came about was actually, you know, I had, this is actually one of my favorite stories. After I got my degree in Russian, I went to the Caribbean, decided to take a break, and always wanted to learn how to sail on the ocean. I'd sailed on lakes and stuff in Indiana and loved it. And so, and I, you know, kept my nose to the grindstone at school and done well. And so I figured I'll just go down there and try to get a job on a sailboat. And, you know, because I had worked as a cook in some places on my summers and was good at it, I figured I'd get a job as a cook on one of these charter sailboats in the Virgin Islands. So I go down there, and before doing so, I actually called. I did my homework because you know, I was a library student, and you know, or actually, I had been halfway through my into my master's degree in library science. Would have been in charge of a Slavic collection, but so I was into doing my homework. And my mother was a librarian and all that kind of stuff, so it made sense. So I make some calls before I go down there, and I talked to I wanted to have somebody that I could meet or something, and I talked to a person that was used to booking these charter boats down there, and asked her if she knew anybody that I could contact when I went down there, and she said, you know, you kind of just have to be there. And then she said, oh, wait a second, there's one person that I can forward you to. And, cause she always, this captain always seems to have her fingers in something. And I don't know what your sensibilities are, but, if depending on that, I mean, you might find her to be of some help, but I should tell you, she's about like 6'5", a lesbian, weighs about 300 pounds. And, you know, and she runs this business with her girlfriend on a sailboat.
And you said, I hope at that point, hey, I'm a survival expert. I can handle anything.
All right. You know,
and a large animal wrangler.
There you go.
I like to think I have an open mind. So, you know, I contacted her when I went down there, and, you know, and she was great. She took me out onto her boat, and she has this big sailboat, and even had a little machine shop in a part of the engine room. And she, you know, she was living at anchor in the tropical clear waters and palm trees all over the place. It was, and I said, you know, wow, this is fantastic. I'd love to be able to do this myself someday. And she said, how much money you got? And a couple weeks later, I had my own boat, and which I paid off through work that she gave me through a diving school down there. And, you know, and I ran that business for 4 years. Eventually, I got tired of it because dealing with tourists day in, day out is a routine. And, you know, I sailed back up to the States with my now wife, who had her brother had a house with a boat slip near it out on Long Island. So we slipped the boat there, and I thought very carefully about what it was that I wanted to do, because here was a situation in the Caribbean that when I got there, I thought, why would anybody want to do anything else? It was fantastic.
Right.
But eventually, because of the way that it was a routine and you're stuck on a small island and, you know, there's nothing to do in the evenings, but, you know, read books and drink and stuff like that. So, and at that time it was, you know, the rum was cheaper down there than the water was, but you know, so I come back up to the States and now I'm focused on it. And I thought about it and I thought, you know, it does make sense actually that if you're going to spend, you know, a lot of your quality time at work, if not most of your best, the best time, when you're most alert and everything at work, you might as well enjoy what you're doing.
Yeah.
So, and a lot of people don't actually think about that, oddly enough. You know, it's like you earn a living doing something, or you do something to earn a living. If you want to have fun, you do that after work or right. something like that. And so I was like, well, I want to have fun and really enjoy what I do. And what exactly is that? And so I spent, months figuring out what exactly that was. And then I set my sights on it and decided that's what I was going to do. And I've been doing that ever since.
Well, I mean, I think you're exactly right. You know, it's funny, Adam, you had mentioned a couple of minutes ago about the idea of like, you know, you're sort of on a path to solve a particular problem, and by happenstance, you stumble upon a greater solution to something else, right? And so, I'm finding that happening in this conversation with you guys today, because something's coming out of this, which is exciting to me, which is a common theme among the three of us. You know, when I was faced at this point in my choice between staying on Wall Street and doing comedy full time, clearly. You know, I think societally, people sort of say, well, you know, you're supposed to go to school and then college, and then you work for 30 years and you retire and you go to Florida, and you don't think about sort of anything outside of that box. And I was faced with this choice of like, well, do I stay on Wall Street where there's security and I'm kind of set, or do I pursue the thing that I'm passionate about where there's no security and I have no idea where my next nickel is going to come from? And I struggle with the decision. But you two have sort of done the same thing in the sense of like, you listened kind of to that internal mechanism, if you will, and not sort of bought into what you think you're supposed to be doing or told to do, and it's worked out in spades. And I think that's hopefully some people will take something take that from this conversation and kind of get that it works. You know, if it that does work if you pursue that kind of life.
You know, I totally agree. I tell you in this, it's funny because this is a very common theme that both Jamie and I get asked about and both of us talk about under many different circumstances. And at the same time, I'm also very cognizant in this current economy that there are not a lot of jobs to go around, and there are a lot of great people who are struggling in all sorts of different markets to find work.
Right.
I get nervous about sounding too like, well, you've just got to follow your dreams and then everything will fall into place.
When, right.
You know, for some people, that's total horseshit.
That, yeah. That's,
you know, that's not helping.
Right.
I will say, though, that each of us found relief valves in different ways of in terms of taking care of things while you were trying to make it work. You know, either it's like, you know, you save really well, or you know that you know that working really hard is going to make people want to hire you more. You
right.
know, I don't think people talk enough about that these days, about busting your ass.
Mm-hmm.
Like that quote about opportunity. It is such a thing to know and to demonstrate that you're willing to bust your ass to do something. And when Jamie first hired me in special effects, I was surprised that even though I had tried to work in this industry several times, I'd rejected it a couple of times. And here now was a circumstance where I really enjoyed working in the place. And I also noticed that at the time Jamie hired me, I was doing a lot of sculpture. I was doing a lot of art, and I was thinking of myself as an artist. And I was spending a lot of time doing group shows and collaborating with people and doing commissions and stuff. And as I started doing more and more, getting more and more into special effects, I noticed that I was doing less of that creative stuff after work because it was totally being satisfied on the job. Like Jamie was saying,
oh, interesting.
The job itself was satisfying that creative impulse. And I thought to myself, okay, number one, I'm never going to say I used to be an artist.
Right.
Number two, this is so rewarding. I'm going to give everything I have to this because
right.
this is clearly something that I can give everything to, and I'm going to get something back out of it. And I really did in spades.
Well,
I've never regretted that decision.
It's funny, you know, because your art background has served you, in your special effects and science aspect of your life, if you will. And my legal sort of business training has served me as a comedian, believe it or not, because I feel like it's allowed me to look at it as a business at times and intelligently and approach it that way. And I think you're right. Like I mean, this is not, you know, I never liked the stories where, yes, he followed his dream and he made it. No, talk about like, you know, I sold my two-bedroom co-op in New York City. I moved to a rooming house with a 300-pound phone sex operator who was doing phone sex calls next to me, and I'm lying in bed going, what have I done with my life? And the doubts and worrying about if you're going to make your mortgage payment or what, you know, how you're going to put your kids through college. It's scary pursuing the dream, but I do think that there's a fascinating theme in this conversation of sort of, you know, that you there is a bit of a rebel in these stories, which is a good thing. You know, you really kind of have to be willing to defy. I mean, look at Jamie. He basically, to the point where his parents said, you know, we're not going to mess with him again. He might call us on our bluff again, right?
I'll tell you, there's a really quintessential story about that happens in a job that I actually turned down from Jamie, but not because of Jamie.
Mm-hmm.
Somewhere in the, in 2000, no, somewhere in 1999, Jamie had gotten a contract to do this film called Monkey Bone, and he called me up and asked me to be a key supervisor in the model shop for the film. And it just so happened that Jamie had a partner at the time that I didn't like working with, and mm-hmm. I didn't want to work on the film. But I talked to him respectfully about, you know, what would the terms be, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And then my wife was just about to have a baby. What turned out to be two babies, twins.
Wow.
And I had gotten work on Bicentennial Man. Mm-hmm. And I was working on it. It was a terrible job. It was awful, awful job. It really is just no fun. The model shop was really unhappy. And here was Jamie offering me a year of work. Hmm. So I could quit Bicentennial Man and go work on Monkey Bone. And I had a guaranteed year of work with, you know, two-month-old twins.
Wow.
And I didn't want to go – I didn't want to work under Jamie's partner. And it was I thought about this, and I thought, I really want to go back to Industrial Light and Magic. And the reason is because they're about to start up episode two. I want to work on episode two, and specifically I want to work in the art department on episode two.
Mm.
And so I went to my wife at the time, now my ex-wife, and I said, look, I've got this weird dilemma. Here's the thing. I need to turn down a year of work on the chance that I'm going to get to work in the art department on episode two. I think I can swing it. But I need you to back me. And my wife said, okay,
wow.
All right, I trust you.
Wow.
And
that's ballsy.
I turned down Monkey Bone. I went up to ILM to have lunch with a colleague, and I got spotted by one of my supervisors up there, and he said, oh, what are you doing? And I got hired on Space Cowboys. I spent 6 months on Space Cowboys and then transitioned from that into the art department on episode two for a few weeks.
Wow.
And it all totally fell into place. But there was, you know, you do have to take those risks at times that don't seem like they're sensible. But, man, and there were, honestly, I'm sure I could call up several times when I took a risk and it didn't pay off. And I, you know, we had to scrape and borrow to pay rent.
But see, the difference is, you know, it's funny because I had a conversation with a comedian the other night who lives outside of New York City and wants to work in the city clubs more, but doesn't want to go in because they don't pay anything. And he's got a wife and a kid out on the island. And what can I say to the kid? It's like, look, if you're not committed to like you got to kind of cut your guts open, you know what I mean? And so I think what you just explained is the difference between people who end up fulfilling their dream and those who don't is when you hit a hurdle in pursuit of your dream, you don't give up. And there's tons of hurdles. I've had them. Jamie's had, right? Steve Jobs, right? The biggest of the big. The difference is, I think, it's in my personal opinion, sort of the people that don't give up and go, okay, well, this isn't working out. I'm a little depressed. I'll let myself be depressed for 3 days. Then I'm going to go back at it or whatever it is.
You know, I'll also give you another example. Back when, before Mythbusters came along, I stopped working for Jamie in commercials somewhere around 1997, mm-hmm. I think. And then we got back together to work on Mythbusters in 2002. In the interim, I was working in Industrial Light and Magic. And Jamie and I would get together for lunch about once a year or twice a year just to talk about stuff. And one of the key things we talked about was, as freelancers, what other industries could we be exploiting besides special effects and film and television? And it was going into toy prototyping. It was going into prototype design, all these different industries and places to go. And it was like actually the main thing that we talked about as professional colleagues is what's next, what's next, what's next, and what's a different place that could use these skills?
Well, yeah, I mean, I took a tour of your – you were nice enough to give me a tour of your shop – thing that stands out, your model making is unbelievable. So one of the things that struck me too, and is in talking about sort of going with your gut and pursuing your passion and overcoming obstacles, is sort of where what religion how religion plays a part in it for you guys. And I think it's fair to say that you're both atheists, and I know have been members and participated in the Skeptic Society. And talk about that a little bit, and what the Skeptic Society is for people who may not know.
So the main Skeptic Society that I'm a member of is James Randi's, the JREF, James Randi Educational Foundation. Mm-hmm. Somewhere, I think in 2004, 2005, Jamie and I, and Carrie Byron, actually, were all invited and went to speak at James Randi's amazing meeting, which happens in the summers in Las Vegas. We were interviewed on stage by Penn Jillette, who's become Penn and Teller are absolutely friends of MythBusters. Mm. And, you know, I'm a third or fourth generation atheist. I'm at least a third generation atheist. Mm. And it's not that I reject religion. I just don't really have any use for it. Mm-hmm. And I do think that organized religion has perpetrated some of the worst crimes on humanity that have ever been recorded.
Yeah.
And to me, one of the worst ones is when you have people rejecting actual scientific data in favor of the things that their faith tells them.
Yeah.
If you want to believe that God is the first guy to trip the domino that led to everything that we have, I have no truck with that. That's fine. I have no problem with that.
Mm.
There's nothing I can say to that. It's not provable or disprovable. So if that comforts you, then that's fine.
Mm.
But if you tell me that the Earth is 6,000 years old, I'm ready for a fight. Because there's nothing useful about that. You get in a plane and you fly somewhere, and the reason that plane gets you there is because of people who actually did critical thinking about a set of discrete experiments and put two and two together in order to make this impossible thin bubble of aluminum that actually pressurizes and takes you from one place to the other. You can't both reject evolution and fly and know that your plane is going to keep you alive. The two are not mutually exclusive.
Right, right. And Jamie, you share similar beliefs, right? I mean, in terms of atheism and sort of, you know, what gets us moving as people.
Well, yeah, I mean, I have a fundamental problem with the very concept of it. I mean, faith, as I understand it, and belief in things, implies that that you don't require any kind of evidence or rationale behind it. It's like you're accepting something just like without question.
Right.
And I don't think that I don't understand why anybody would want to do that.
Yeah. What I don't like about the discourse is that sort of if you have any view or that's away from the Bible, so to speak, that you're somehow there's something wrong with you. You're somehow not a religious person in your own way. I mean, religion can, you know, and it can be a very broad term, and it doesn't necessarily have to mean that you go to a particular house of worship, and you know, you can have your own internal God that works for you, and that's what's just upsetting about the conversation on some level to me, is sort of people want to compartmentalize people instead of sort of being open to you know, hearing the other side of the conversation.
Well, and I kind of have a fundamental problem with you know, again, the problem with believing in something without requiring any kind of rationale behind it,
right,
sort of opens up a Pandora's box. Mm. You know, there's things like personal responsibility goes out the window.
Absolutely,
you know, it's like,
yeah.
I'm doing this, or I think this, and I'm behaving this way because of something that doesn't necessarily have to be ethical or make sense.
Absolutely.
You know, it's like ethical according to standards. I think there are certain kinds of you know, fundamental ethical things that you know, like compassion or you know, like cruelty is a bad thing. You know, it's like these don't require a God to be able to get behind.
Right. Exactly.
And so, you know, but when you, if you have a God that you know, all of a sudden you've got a license to break some of those fundamental things.
Mm-hmm.
I can make a rational argument why someone should not be cruel or, or unethical in society.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You know, and yet when you have, if you have some sort of a way of behavior that legitimizes ignoring those things, then I think that's a really horrible thing.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm going to wrap this up in a minute, but I just want to ask you, what happens at the Skeptics Society? What do you guys talk about? What is the conversation? I mean, I'm fascinated by that.
You know, right now, one of the biggest issues that the JREF has is both outreach to a new generation. One of the reasons that the Amazing Meeting is held in the summers in Las Vegas is so that teachers, who are a key part of our critical thinkers teaching new generations, so that teachers can actually attend. Mm-hmm. And then one of the others is a thing that Randy has been doing, sort of the front page of the JREF for the past, several decades, has been the James Randi Challenge, in which he has offered $1 million to anyone who can demonstrate a paranormal ability. And to date, nobody has collected the money. The terms are almost always identical, in which somebody is allowed to perform the thing that they say they can do, whether they can read a newspaper blindfolded or they can find water by dowsing. They're allowed to do it in the way that they normally do it.
Mm-hmm.
And then they are required to do it under precise laboratory conditions.
Wow.
And nobody has yet succeeded in achieving any of their quote unquote paranormal abilities under the laboratory conditions.
Now, do you go into that with the idea that you don't believe that there are, or are you open to the idea that it could be? Are you hoping secretly? Are you hoping, as a man of science, if you will, for purposes of this part of the conversation, that you're skeptical and you don't really believe it and you want to disprove it by putting this out there? Are you hoping that they can do it?
No, I would love to find out that it's possible. Mm-hmm. I would absolutely love to find out that it's possible.
Right.
You know, I tell you, maybe we can find a pair of people that can actually seem to communicate telepathically.
Right, right.
Right? And maybe, I don't know if you saw that recently, this story came out about a video camera that can slow down and look at color with real precision and can actually see on your face the color of your face changing as your heart beats. Right?
Wow.
Now, at the same time, whenever you read, you actually do something called subvocalization. Mm-hmm. You actually move the muscles that make your mouth talk on a very low grade level, and it's a key way in which our bodies understand words as we're reading. You must subvocalize in order to understand what you're reading. And there are machines that people have built that can actually read that muscle movement and extrapolate the language that you are barely making the muscle movements to illustrate and actually understand. And maybe there are two people that can stare at each other across a room and actually communicate. That may not be telepathy as we think of brainwaves traveling over the air, but if such a thing was possible, I have to hope that I would be completely open to the possibility of that.
Absolutely, absolutely.
I would also be open to the possibility that something I hold as axiomatic in science, if it gets disproven, I'm willing to eject it. I mean, the thing about science is that it doesn't prefer one mode of looking at the world over the other. This whole idea about, you know, this whole bullshit of teaching to the controversy about the theory of evolution misunderstands the most fundamental thing about science, which is that we're going to operate as if this very testable thing is a fact until some better facts come along. And when they do, we are going to augment or adjust or change our views based on this new information.
Yeah, no, that's a great way of putting it. Just to finish up, a fan over Twitter asked me to ask you, is there such a thing as long-lasting lipstick, or is it a myth? and if you don't have an answer, could you test it someday?
Long-lasting lipstick. I have like 5 jokes for that.
Well,
none of them are appropriate.
I might be able to test it, but not by putting it on.
Come on. I think you'd look great in some lipstick. Well, just to wrap up for people listening, I always like to have people who have fascinating jobs and are fascinating people, and certainly you both are. What advice do you have for anybody out there, whether it's somebody young kind of figuring out what they want to do, or somebody, it sounds like in the case of the three of us, or at one point thought we knew what we wanted to do and then turned out we ended up doing something else. Like, what would you say to people out there based on the experiences that you've had up to date?
Can I go first?
Yes.
Yeah, by all means.
I would say that people should be aware that sometimes the most valuable things that they'll ever run across are not things that they were actually looking for.
Right. That's a really good point.
It's funny. I was going to say something based along very similar lines, and that people ask, how do I – Jamie and I are going to do a show tonight. We take questions from the audience. One of the first questions we usually get is, how do I become a Mythbuster? What should I study in college? And our answer is always everything.
Yep.
Everything that you're interested in is something that you should dip your feet into and see if it has if it takes over for you, or if it's got some staying power. You know, I don't know if you've read Steve Martin's book, Born Standing Up.
Yes.
But there's a great bit in it when he says that at the beginning of his career, someone told him something that turned out to be incredibly true, which was, they said, as you proceed along your career, you'll find that you will use everything you have ever learned.
Absolutely. I mean, you talk about sort of your art background, and I'm sure that's the reason that Jamie thought you were very accurate and very fast when he saw your work, right? I mean, because you'd sort of had sort of been building models in a sense, even though you didn't know you were doing that early on. It's absolutely true what Steve Martin said. I found it to be the case.
And you know, the if you're interested in something, the people that we work with on the show and in special effects, I always call them Swiss Army knives. They're interested in a little bit of everything.
That's a great term. Well, listen, I can't thank you enough for this. This was so fascinating for me. I mean, I know you guys a bit, but just what I learned about you is just endlessly fascinating, and I hope our listeners find it to be the case. I'm sure they will. Thank you so much for your time and your generosity, and you guys are great.
Paul, that was a lot of fun. I really appreciate you having us on.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you. It was a lot of fun.
Thank you. I appreciate it, and I want to see you with lipstick on. I think you're going to look great. All right. Take care, guys.
Bye, Paul.
Bye-bye.
We take over one borough at a time. Secure our territory. Secure our turf. Because it's all our turf.